Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
I'm Erica Wise, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are once again recording here in at Roberta's Pizza in two shipping containers at 261 Moore Street in lovely Bushwick, Brooklyn. Today is a beautiful spring-like day.
The first.
It sounds like we're going to probably have an early spring this year, according to the Farmer's Almanac.
Oh, it's here.
Yeah, it's here.
In my mind.
Yeah, it's arrived. And today is the last show of this winter season.
Yes.
And before we begin the show today, we just wanted to do a little shout out to one of our listeners who sent us a really, really sweet message on Facebook. Her name is Emily, and she lives in Santa Barbara.
From New York.
She wrote to us to tell us how much she loved the show and how much she has learned about gardening from our podcast. She moved from a small apartment in New York City to her new home in California a couple of years ago, and she's making a garden for the first time. And it was really great to hear from her. She sent us pictures of her succulents. She's really into gardening, and it's really, really great to hear from listeners. And we encourage you all to write to us, even in between seasons, to stay in touch. Alice and I are going to be posting throughout the entire time all of our work that we're doing this spring and summer. And we should be doing a couple of sort of seasonal summer shows as well this year, like we did last year. So keep in touch. Keep following us into the next season, and we're going to keep bringing you great stories.
So today, we just wrapped up our month-long series of Horticulture in America.
Yeah.
And today's show, although not officially in that series, I think it's a perfect one to bridge the series and our ending
season.
Annual year of shows. Yeah. Because it's about big trees, and it's about America's big trees and the importance of these trees. A book just came out called The Man Who Planted Trees, A Story of Lost Groves, The Science of Trees, and A Plan to Save the Planet. And it was written by Jim Robbins. And it's the story of our guest today, David Millarc. And just, I'm just going to set the tone a little bit about forests and the importance of these, of the trees. So I think we've all kind of heard the description of what America was like back when Henry Hudson landed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the idea of a squirrel could run from the coast of New England all the way inland to the Mississippi River on a canopy of trees. It was that forested. So I'm just going to talk for a minute. I'm going to read from the book just to set the tone. The great hardwood forests of the East Coast are in terrible shape. When the Europeans landed, the forests were so thick, it's often been said that a squirrel could travel from the Atlantic coast to the Mississippi River without touching the ground. Squirrels cannot make that journey anymore. Dr. Doug Tallamy, who heads the Center for Managed Ecosystems at the University of Delaware in Newark, lists figures in his book, Bringing Nature Home, that cut to the heart of this problem. 75% of the forests along the eastern seaboard are gone. In the lower 48 states, 43,500 square miles are paved with asphalt, an area five times the size of New Jersey. And 62,500 square miles are covered with sterile, nature-free lawns, an area eight times the size of New Jersey. We've turned 54% of the lower 48 into a suburban matrix. Homes, roads, malls, and 41% into various forms of agriculture. And each year, sprawl gobbles up 2 million more acres of wild land, an area the size of Yellowstone National Park. Large-scale forests are extremely rare. Most are highly fragmented, shot through with roads, and riddled with exotic species. According to the U.S. Forest Service, according to U.S. Forest Service research, half of the existing eastern forest is subject to edge effects. But more relevant is the fact that most of the edge effects exists where people live, and that's where the ecosystem services that trees offer, such as cooling and cleansing, are most in demand, and will even be more so as temperatures warm. So, just to give a little, like, weight to this issue, that's the status. That's where we are as a country. This is what we've done to our forests and to our land. One of the most important things forests do for life on the planet is to capture carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and store it as plant tissue. Trees contain half of the terrestrial stores, more than any other single source on land. Otherwise, the carbon dioxide would still be in the atmosphere, causing more warming. So today we're going to talk with David Millark, who is doing angelic work to save the trees. He is cloning the giant trees. Welcome, David.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, especially on a beautiful, warm spring day, finally.
Exactly. We all need it. And you are in Michigan right now, is that right?
Yes, very close to Traverse City, Michigan, in northern Michigan.
Yes.
A beautiful place to be.
It is a beautiful place. I've been there many times. I have a lot of family in Traverse City, so I know it quite well. David, tell us about your background in horticulture, and tell us about the dream you had and the near-death experience.
Well, our grandchildren that live on this large parcel of land are the sixth generation here. I'm the fourth generation. All continuously living on this large family farm. So we've been here a long time. We go way back. And for the last four generations, we've been in the shade tree production industry.
Mm-hmm.
My father, after World War II, came home from the Air Force and with J. Frank Schmidt out in Oregon, helped pioneer and develop shade tree production, that industry,
mm-hmm.
right after World War II, growing shade trees so they could be replanted as we urbanize the planet. So we've been in it a long, long time,
mm-hmm.
from the beginning. And I began to notice about 20 years ago that the bread and butter species of trees that we grew and sold to cities like Minneapolis, Detroit, Chicago, Denver, the same trees that you have there in New York City, I've been there a number of times,
mm-hmm.
were beginning to die. And they were beginning to die when they hadn't died before, and that was our sole livelihood, and we could not figure out why the trees that have always worked aren't working anymore, why they were dying right down the road in the nursery.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there was a lot of exotic pests that were imported from other countries, but usually you could see those to see what that problem is. But there was a general decline in the health of the native forest and death in our shade trees that we were growing.
Mm-hmm.
And after much research, 20 years ago, there wasn't much known about this. We found out it was from air pollution, primarily from the SO2s released from coal-fired power plants. And it has since been traced, that SO2 pollution, from a coal-fired power plant all the way from Michigan to California and all the way to China. So as China burns more and more coal, it comes across the Pacific Ocean, all the way across America, condenses over the Great Lakes, and we have acid rain. Also, we have mercury, dioxins that drop on our inland lakes, our rivers, and all of our soil. Well, it doesn't all drop here. It keeps heading east, and the decline in the native forests on the East Coast and almost to the extinction of Christmas tree production on the East Coast is from coal-fired power plants primarily. That was pretty shocking.
Yeah. You actually just sent me an email earlier today. I'm on your list. And it was about the night of the GOP, the last debate, you know, when Trump was talking about
His fingers
and
other body parts.
Other people were talking about body parts,
yeah.
And not about the real issues, that a very serious situation occurred on that night.
Yesterday, Bill McKibben, of course, he is one of the loudest voices and advocates for CO2,
right,
and excess carbon in our atmosphere. We have crossed over the 2-degree rise in temperature. That dreaded 2 degrees that most scientists and a lot of the world leaders thought would happen at the end of this century, we crossed over that just recently in the last few days.
Right.
And pretty much the effects from that 2 degrees rise in temperature will create massive, massive ocean rise levels, massive declines in our ability to grow food in large parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of happening in 60 years from now, it's happened already. So now more than ever, we need to replace the natural filter system and the phytoremediation systems, or whisking the excess CO2 out of our air, out of our atmosphere, and store that carbon away safely. And everyone listening to this, no matter where in the world you're listening or what you're doing, you could be a part of that solution. That's really needed now more than ever. And that was a feature story, I believe, at today's Boston Globe.
Yes.
Well,
right.
What we had feared and what we had hoped we would not live to see has happened already, and it will definitely and dramatically affect the quality of life for our children and our grandchildren. And that is the truth.
Absolutely. And it's happening, like you said, I mean, this year could very, very positively affect tomorrow, or, you know, this day can affect tomorrow. And what we, it's that dire of a situation, right?
And yet there's still people denying that
right.
It's happening, you know, which is terrible.
So, well, usually those people are supported by big industry.
Yeah.
That does not want the truth to go out because
right.
It would interfere their greedy business practices. That's usually what it boils down to, but be that as it may, I'm not here to play the blame game.
Right.
The entire East Coast of the United States will probably be underwater. That includes all of New York City.
Right.
You are slated to go underwater no matter where you live on the East Coast of the United States.
Yeah.
So tell us about your vision and how you came to cloning these giants, and then let's get into some of the specifics of the trees.
Well, quite frankly and quite honestly, about 20 years ago, I had total renal failure, which means that your kidneys and your livers, they both quit.
Mm-hmm.
And once you go into renal failure, you have a few days, very few days, before you cannot release the toxins out of your body and you die.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's exactly what happened to me, and I passed over in the Frankfurt Hospital here in northern Michigan, and they couldn't bring me back, but I was determined not to die. I had 2 small children there with my wife, and I got into an argument with the doctor. He said, "You have 24 hours to live." And I said, "No, I am not going to die." He goes, "Yes, you are." Well, lo and behold, we both were right. I did die. He was right. But a very much surprise to him and a lot of his staff and my family is that About 45 minutes later, I came back into my body. I had a full-blown, documented near-death experience, and I went over to the other side. Much to my surprise, because I'm not a religious person. I did not attend church, and I still don't attend churches. But I've become very spiritual. And when I was on the other side, I was told that I couldn't stay. They were sending me back because they had work for me to do. Well, I had no idea what that meant. I was, because you can only imagine. I really didn't understand what was going on fully, but back I came. And about 2 months later, I woke up in the middle of the night to a very bright light in our bedroom, my wife and I. And I was asked to go out into the living room and sit down in my leather chair, take a legal pad with me and a pen, and that's all I remember, really. And 4 hours later, when I came to, the outline for this project of cloning the world's largest and oldest trees and archiving them on an ark like Noah was asked in a lot of religious belief to bring the animals on two by two to preserve the animals. Well, I had been given the task to bring the tree genetics on two by two and help clone the great trees of the earth and preserve those genetics in a genetic archive. And I know this sounds preposterous, and it sounds, I know it would test anybody's rational thinking. Trust me, it did mine, but that was the task that I was given. I had no idea how to accomplish it, but I set out to do it because I believed what I had experienced. I was pretty confident it was real. So that's how this began.
I remember, David, when we walked, Alice and I met you. We attended your lecture in Boston
at New England Grows,
right? And we go to lots of conferences, and you go to lots of different, lectures, and they don't seem like spiritual experiences, you know? But when we walked into that room, and I heard you speaking, and I saw you standing there and speaking, it was like televangelism, but for plants. It was a really special moment that I'll never forget, and Alice and I both said, we have to have them on the show.
And the book is really great. Jim Robbins has done a great job outlining the situation and then telling your story. So you wrote down on this legal pad the outline, and then how did you go about it? How did you start this project?
Well, let me back up just a little bit. Jim Robbins is a 30-year-plus New York Times, Science Times reporter.
Right.
And I'm sure your listeners will understand to be a Science Times reporter for the New York Times globally for 30 years. You're one of the best researchers, especially in science,
right,
and writers on the planet.
Right.
Well, Jim followed myself and our team around for 10 years, taking notes and studying the new science that was coming out about trees, why trees are important, why trees are a lot more than just firewood or an ornament to sit under for shade.
Right.
And the science in his book, The Man Who Planted Trees, is phenomenal. It's state-of-the-art, the latest science of why trees are important, their function, why they are important to you, to whoever you are, wherever you are listening, why they impact the quality of your life. And now, how trees could be the solution to help reverse climate change.
Exactly.
They really can. They could be the catalyst to sequester the carbon and also, just as importantly, to produce the oxygen that we need so much in our oceans, in our atmosphere, because our O2 oxygen levels are dropping dramatically in our oceans, so much so that it really has endangered the ability of mammals to reproduce in our oceans.
Right.
It's really serious.
And now you have a quest, right, for every American or every person on the planet to aid in this, right? When we were at the New England Grows, you said if every one person were to plant 5 trees a year, this could be eliminated, the situation.
If every single human being on this earth planted 4 trees a year for 20 years, that doesn't mean in your yard, but if you did that with a tree planting group or with your church or with your synagogue or with your schools or whatever that is.
Right.
If every human being planted 4 trees a year in 20 years, we would have negated all the excess carbon in this atmosphere.
Yeah.
That reduced it, brought it back to the baseline. That's all we have to do. But if we don't do that in a concerted effort, every single person, and pass the buck, I can only imagine what our children and our grandchildren could live and will live to see.
Mm-hmm.
So we all have a choice, every single one of us. We could not pay attention. We could not do it. Or we can pass the buck how busy or we don't have the money. And our grandchildren will inherit a planet that some scientists say that we have 50 years left as human species on planet Earth. That's it. In 50 years, the planet will be in such terrible shape, human existence is no longer an option. So that's the two options that we all face today. I'm here to do my very best to encourage people to see to it that 4 trees a year per family member get planted somewhere by someone to offset and go after this terrible challenge that our children and our grandchildren are inheriting. That's why I do what I do, and I think it's important that we do it with the right trees in the right place.
Okay. All right, we have to take a break. Hang on to the line, David. We have to do some corporate sponsorship, and we will be right back to talk more with you about the specific trees that you're cloning and how you identify them and all that good, fun horticulture stuff.
Great.
Today's program is proudly brought to you by Whole Foods Market, America's healthiest grocery store with more than 400 locations throughout the United States. Download the Whole Foods Market app on your smartphone for recipes, sales, information, and digital coupons. Or visit WholeFoodsMarket.com to find a store closest to you.
Hi, welcome back to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Alice and I are talking about saving the planet with trees.
Yeah.
With David Millarc with the Archangel Ancient Tree Survey. So, David, let's get into identifying the trees for cloning. How does it work? And also tell people about some of the resistance that you met when you were first trying to do it. People were telling you that you couldn't do it. It wasn't possible.
Yes. When the first project first came through, and it was such a rare concept of trying to clone trees that are several hundred to several thousand years old, and almost every academic expert that found out about the project that we asked said, well, it's impossible. The trees are too big and too old, and it's like asking a 110-year-old woman to bear children. It won't work. There's things in these trees that prevent them from reproducing, so you're wasting your time and ours, so we're not interested. And we ran up against that across the board.
Wow.
Because some of the trees that we had targeted to try and clone are 3,000 years old.
Mm-hmm.
A tree that was 1,000 years old when Jesus walked the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it was daunting, and we were not able to find anyone in the academic world or actually in the tree world that had any faith that we would be able to clone these trees. Well, thankfully, there were ways and methods that we created to ask these trees to be able to clone themselves. And by the way, almost every tree species on Earth is self-cloning. They do it themselves naturally and normally. So we're not asking them to change their genetics, or we weren't really asking them to do anything they normally don't do, but no one had any success in doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was 20 years ago. I'm happy to say that Archangel Ancient Trees, we've done about 170 different species of the largest measured tree of each species, including trees that are over 4,000 years old, like the bristlecone pine. Mm-hmm. Some of the giant sequoias that we've cloned in California have a trunk diameter of over 30 feet. So they're over 30 foot across the trunk.
Mm-hmm.
We've been successful in those. And why are we doing this? Because the trees that we're planting in New York City, New York State, the East Coast, and all of the rest of America were never chosen for longevity or, in most cases, disease resistance. They were chosen for a pretty flower, a pretty leaf color, or no thought was really ever given to helping rebuild the ecosystem that we've all destroyed by turning our planet into a parking lot and subdivisions and cities.
Mm-hmm.
So as we destroyed the natural ecosystem, which is a lot more than just trees, that ecosystem is critical for all life on this planet. But we didn't understand it because we hadn't studied it.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly didn't study the trees before. By the way, an accurate stat is that we have taken down 98% of the old growth trees in the United States. We only have 2% of the old growth trees left. That's what we're passing on to our children. But before we deforested all these trees, we didn't study any of them. We didn't study the ecosystems, and we didn't know what critical life support systems those trees, which are part of the ecosystem, like on Long Island, like in New York City, what roles they really played to the critical services that they give to all living things, including human beings.
Right.
Like, back then, we didn't even know that trees communicate with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And now we know they do.
Mm-hmm.
We did not know that trees aerosol out natural aerosols that are critical for bees, for all pollinators, for birds, and for humans, that help strengthen our immune system with natural antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't understand that then. There is so much that we've learned. It's all in Jim's book, The Man Who Planted Trees. By the way, I don't receive any royalties. I chose not to. There's such a critical role that we all need to hurry up, get busy, quit making excuses, and help rebuild the natural filter system before it's too late for our grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it boils down to. And trees are the skeleton of most ecosystems.
So, David, tell us a bit about the cloning process. Can you describe, you have some great photos on your website of tree climbers and you know, tree experts going up into the canopies of these massive trees. And what do they do? What do they collect and how do they clone them?
Well, let's bring it a little bit closer to home to your audience. Some of the work that we've done, we did Teddy Roosevelt's tree at Sagamore Hill there on Long Island,
mm-hmm.
the original old-growth, virgin old-growth beech trees that were on his estate. We also took part in cloning the great trees of Central Park,
mm-hmm.
and that is we asked climbers to go up to the very tops of these trees. And then after they climbed to the top, we asked them to go out to the end of the branches and take this year's new growth, or whatever new growth grew this year, whether it be 2 inches long or 4 inches long or 6 inches long. We have found that the most juvenile material from the very tops and the end of the branches of these big trees, that gives us our best chance to ask that tree to reproduce itself. That's one of the secrets that we found, because most people were taking and trying to clone trees from the bottom branches, which are a lot easier to get at.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we went to the top of the trees and out to the end of the branches, voila, it started to work. And some of these trees, bear in mind, are almost 400 feet tall, 40 stories tall. So that was one of the main breakthroughs that we had, was using material from that area. We bring it down. And we have four different methods that we use at our propagation facility here at Archangel Ancient Trees. And one is simply like a geranium or any other thing. We ask it to be a rooted cutting. But we do it in mist chambers with controlled temperature, with controlled pH of the mist, with controlled light. That is one method. And the second method is that we use micropropagation or tissue culturing, or taking very small 1/8 to 1/4 inch long pieces of this tissue, putting them in an agar and in a glass jar, sealing the jar with a very, very special mixture of hormones and different ingredients, and ask them to form a root. Mm-hmm. The other way that is possible is air layering, but we don't use that too much. That's for tropical trees. And let's see, what else? Another method, like with one of Teddy Roosevelt's trees there at Sagamore Hill, one of the beech trees that they had every family party and wedding under, we went and we took the material off that tree and we grafted it onto the base of the same species of trees. Because it wouldn't do it any other way. It wouldn't survive any other way. So as that graft began to grow, we took material off the grafted piece that was juvenile, and lo and behold, it would allow us to clone it. So we used a same species tree to hook it to be a surrogate parent until the juvenile material we found it to work. So all of these methods are pretty standard methods, but we had to go into hybrid mode and recreate all the agars and the systems and when we took the material from the trees, how we took it, how we handled it, temperature, and we have some people, my son Jake and his partner Tom, work around the clock trying to figure out new ways to ask these great giant trees that are several thousand years old to work. So that's basically what it is.
Has there been a tree, David, that you've really struggled with that you have yet to be able to clone?
No. We have stayed with trees. We have done 20,000 cuttings over 7 years to get one to work. Mm-hmm. But once we lock into a tree, we will not quit. And this could be years and years and years till we find the method to break through. So far, I think, to be honest, I think we have about a 97-98% success rate with trees that are the largest measured of their species, not just in this country, but around the world.
And then, can I ask you what happens then when you've got this root, right? And what is the library of trees at your facility, or are you sharing this and spreading the wealth around, or tell me how that's working?
Yeah. We're putting these trees' genetics in archival living libraries,
okay,
or like nurseries that are indoors and outdoors, to preserve and protect these trees and their genetics for all time. So we've begun building one of these genetic libraries in England at the Eden Project.
Ah.
In England, we have one archival living library in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
We have one here in Michigan, and we hope to put one somewhere in the Long Island area of New York. So we're spreading them out. We also have one in Ireland. We're spreading them out in case of a natural disaster. We don't lose the important genetics of these trees due to, you know, an act of God. But what's really even more critical and more important that we do with these trees, and we've been doing this for 3 or 4 years, is we're actually going back and rebuilding for the first time in the history of the world. We're literally rebuilding old-growth forests with clones of trees that are several hundred to several thousand years old. So the clones that we're planting, even though they're only a foot or 18 inches high, are several thousand years old in some cases.
Mm-hmm.
That's never been done. And we're doing that now in 8 countries. But we're a nonprofit, and we can only do as much as the generosity of people from around the world that go to our website, which is archangelancienttrees.org, and help support this work, not just in this country, but around the world. But it's a message, and it's a project of hope. Yes, we have gargantuan environmental challenges that we're facing right here today.
Mm-hmm.
But that does not mean that it has to turn out the way that most people see that scenario playing out. There's lots we can all do to reverse this. In fact, if all of us everywhere were just to plant 4 trees per year, in 20 years we would not have this problem. And that's just basically putting back what we destroyed or rebuilding the natural ecosystem. That's all we have to do.
David, where are you getting your money right now? Do you have a big fundraising campaign going on?
Starting the end of this week or the beginning of next week, we're going to do a crowd fundraiser on our website, Archangel Ancient Trees, and there are many, many trees on the West Coast, redwoods, sequoias, and on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
Are very important to really start to rebuild the natural forest systems of both coasts, because there's been research in Japan, and it's in the book, that if you put the trees back on the coastlines, the fish stocks come back, because fish depend on the tannic acid and some of the things that are in the trees for their survival. So I would really highly urge everyone to read Jim's book, The Man Who Planted Trees, because the science will not only encourage you, you'll see how powerful just planting a few trees a year for each of these people, but they cannot be the ornamental trees. They have to be native trees, the strongest native trees from that region. And we do have trees from the East Coast that are available if people go to our website. How do you get a hold of these trees? We do not sell any trees. We're mandated by our board not to sell any trees. But if people are willing to help the project, which is a 501c3,
uh-huh.
we'll see to it that your organization, your city, your people, your school will receive some of the trees to begin this transformation of rebuilding the natural ecosystem.
And
just go to our website.
Right. And one of the places could be at hospitals.
Right.
Absolutely.
Were there?
Absolutely.
That's a great
talk about trees at hospitals. That was a fantastic segment.
Yes. Yes.
From your New England Grows talk.
Well, we know that 150 years ago, people used to build sanitariums for TB, people that had TB, near pine forests, because, quite simply, the patients got better quicker and more of them did. They didn't understand about the aerosols or the phenols from the pine trees, those aerosols that the patients were breathing. It really helped aid them in their recovery. But it started back then of putting hospitals near places where people, even if people can look out the window and see a tree, there's hard science now that proves, and it's in the book, Jim researched it well, and it's footnoted, that if people could even see a tree out their hospital window, chances are greater that they're going to heal, and they'll heal more quickly just by looking at a tree outside the window. But there's new science coming in every month. The aerosols of some of these trees hold great promise.
Mm-hmm.
Like the black walnuts. I would love to see every school, every hospital, every borough in New York City and the whole entire East Coast plant a native black walnut tree so the aerosols from that black walnut can be inhaled or breathed in by the young girls in your school, your area, or wherever you live, because there is great promise in breast cancer and the elimination of breast cancer in our young girls and our women just by inhaling aerosols out of native black walnut trees.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if they would take a leaf, crush the leaf, and take the liquid from that leaf and rub on their wrists. The body will pick up some very important things that really help prevent our young girls from the scourge of breast cancer. There's really promising research being done on that. That's the power of some of these trees. Now, if we would put three or four in each schoolyard, K-12 and at university, so that when our young girls and our women walked by them
mm-hmm.
and they inhaled these aerosols, it would go a long way in preventing them from having to face a ghastly future of a mastectomy. There's science work being done on that. It's in Jim's book. Black willows have aerosols that are important for our fish. Black willows that we cut down so we can see the river or the lake or the ocean better, the hundreds of millions on the East Coast, we now know put out aerosols and pollen, the very first pollen, like right now, that has natural antibiotics in that pollen that the bees, the butterflies, and all living things take back to the brood, even the fish. It aerosols out of the roots. They feed it to the young, and it's a boost for their natural immune systems, much
right.
like mother's milk is for babies. So we need to put the black walnuts back, the black willows also, in our wet areas, our riparian areas, along our rivers and streams, and even where our stormwater runoff is in the cities. Mm-hmm. So it'll help the bees, help the fish, help our children, help all the pollinators. And it's simple things like that that are so powerful in reversing where we're heading right now by not knowing these things.
Jim, I'm unfortunately, the 45 minutes is up, and I feel like I've got so many questions.
Yes. We need like 3 hours with
yeah.
you.
Yeah. And I just I just encourage our readers to go to the website, learn more about David's work, read Jim's book.
There's so much we haven't touched on. There's okay, important work happening in Ireland, the wonder stumps we didn't cover.
Yeah.
There's a lot. There's so much more
and just
in the book
history,
and on the website.
The natural history of all these trees and how the forests have been treated. The book is just so amazing, and it's very readable. It's a quick read because he's an amazing writer. He digests things perfectly. But David, your work in cloning this is just unbelievable. Carmen and I met at the Horticultural Society of New York, which is where we both worked, if you don't know what the Hort Society is, it's probably one of the first societies in the United States. It was founded by the Rockefellers. It was founded by the Astors. And Carmen and I met because of the library and because of the books. And libraries and what they hold are the most important thing, I think, to our future. And just thank you for all the work you're doing and for taking time and sharing your story with us.
Well, we're willing to share and teach every one of your school children from fourth grade through university level with tree school. We have tree school now at Archangel Ancient Trees, and if we can find the funding, we'll come and we'll teach your children right in their classroom how to do everything that it is we need to do and that we are doing. So they can be, it's called propagating the propagators.
So great.
And we'll share this information with your children and empower them and help turn this thing around. But I thank you for the honor of being able to be on your show, and I hope people find it interesting.
Oh, I know they
do. And I hope that people will donate.
And plant some trees.
And plant some trees.
It's very simple.
Alice and I are about to start planting trees again.
Well, it's sure important.
Yeah, it's very simple.
Well, thank you, thank you so much, David. And thank you all for listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. You can follow us on Facebook at Groundworks, Inc. We Dig Plants. And you can see us planting trees this season. You can follow us on Twitter at We Dig Plants and also at Instagram and see great photos at Groundworks Gardens NYC, where you can see us doing all the work that gardeners do throughout this next season.
So thanks for listening. Keep in touch and have a great spring season.
See you in the gardens.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.